Hello, I'm Rob, and you're listening to the Black Country Talking News for Wednesday, 6th of January, 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity, Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post. This remains in paper envelopes and not the usual plastic wallets, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods. Calling 01902 213 210. Visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website www.blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. And reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Edward, Helen, Lisa, David, Christine, Ian, Angela, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country, we have the Flashback Quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, and on This Week in History with Flashback Roger, a look at how the Black Country Living Museum has taken social media platform TikTok by storm, the weather, Beacon Voices, an edition from Tales at the Barn from Graham Fisher. But before we kick off this week's edition, we return to Simon, who has information regarding the government's introduction of a national lockdown in England to tackle the corona pandemic.
The following information is an audio guide of the government national COVID-19 lockdown restrictions. You must stay at home. You must not leave or be outside of your home except where necessary. You may leave home for the following reasons: to shop for basic necessities for you or a vulnerable person, to go to work or provide voluntary or charitable services if you cannot reasonably do so from home, to exercise with your household or support bubble or one other person. This should be limited to once per day and you should not travel outside of your local area. To meet your support bubble or childcare bubble where necessary, but only if you are legally permitted to form one. To seek medical assistance, avoid injury, illness or risk of harm. This includes domestic abuse. To attend education or childcare, but only for those eligible. Colleges, primary and secondary schools remain open only for vulnerable children and children of critical workers. All other children will learn remotely until February half term. Early year settings remain open. The higher education provision will remain online until mid-February for all except future critical worker courses. If you do leave home for a permitted reason, you should always stay local in the village, town or part of the city where you live. You may leave your local area for legally permitted reasons, such as for work. If you are clinically extremely vulnerable, you should only go out for medical appointments, exercise or if it is absolutely essential, you should not attend work. You cannot leave your home to meet socially with anyone you do not live with or are not in a support bubble with if you are legally permitted to form one. You may exercise on your own, with one other person or with your household or support bubble. You should not meet other people you do not live with or have formed a support bubble with unless for a permitted reason. You should stay 2 metres apart from anyone not in your household.
Thanks for that information, Simon. Now we have our first block of local news, brought to you by Angela, Ian, and first up, Christine.
COVID-19 vaccinations are now underway at a Black Country hospital as work continues on their new £3 million emergency department. The Dudley Group NHS Foundation's Russell's Hall Hospital was recently named as a hospital hub for the coronavirus vaccination programme. It began receiving supplies of the vaccine between Christmas and the New Year, with patients over the age of 80, including those without patient appointments, being prioritised. along with high-risk frontline staff. Trust Chief Executive Diane Wake said, "We are delighted to be able to carry out vaccinations and are following the national guidance on priority groups. I am especially proud of the way staff have worked tirelessly, giving up days off, weekends and holiday to get our vaccination centre up and running. We all believe that this will make a real difference in the fight against COVID, but need the public to play their part by continuing to follow all the measures in place and remember hands, face and space. That remains our best defence at the moment." It comes as new aerial photographs show the scale of work taking place to build the new acute medical unit at the hospital. The new unit, once completed, will link with the emergency department and treat seriously unwell patients, helping to reduce winter pressures on health services. Construction work is ongoing to complete the facility. The Trust received £3 million from the government for the project. It is anticipated the site will open early this year.
Businesses could disappear for good across the West Midlands and Staffordshire without further government support, leaders have warned. Chiefs have said the hospitality sector, alongside non-essential retail, have been left facing even more hardship as a result of closing due to Tier 4 measures. It has led to them calling for more support from the government in order to help ensure businesses can survive throughout the difficult period. West Midlands Mayor Andy Street said, "The obvious consequences of the new restrictions is further closures of businesses, including in the retail and fitness sectors. This will be desperately disappointing for those businesses that would normally be entering what is traditionally a busy and profitable period. Instead, after enjoying the Christmas and early sales rush, they now have to worry about survival." Mr. Street said his hope and expectation was there would eventually be an agreement by the government to offer more support for businesses across the region, which will help them survive the impact of Tier 4.
A craft shop owner has said she is heartbroken as her business has had to close again due to new restrictions. The West Midlands moved into Tier 4 on December 31st, meaning all non-essential shops have had to close. Tracy Spilsbury, who has owned Wolfram Woolen Crafts on Cleveland Street in Wolverhampton for 21 years, believes there should have been a national lockdown rather than local lockdown. She said, "I'm frustrated that other shops, such as Hobbycraft in Telford, can stay open. This is totally wrong. These local restrictions are hitting independent shops again. This business is my life. You build it back up to have it taken away from you again. I just think, when is it going to end? When are independent shops going to get a chance to survive? After 21 years, I didn't think that something like this would be the biggest challenge of my life, and it's heartbreaking to watch my business struggle like this. I am lucky that I have some really loyal customers who've already called me to check I'm okay. Without their support, I would be lost. Small businesses have taken all of the precautions they can. We've been cleaning, have screens up, sanitizers, gloves, one-way systems, and yet it's us who are suffering, not the big supermarkets where they don't take all of these precautions. The craft industry has been huge for people's mental health, especially this year, so they should be classed as essential, like garden centres are. Why aren't we as essential as an off-licence?"
A task force is being launched to tackle the crisis of unemployment across the West Midlands. Ian Brookfield, leader of Wolverhampton Council, will chair the organisation on behalf of the West Midlands Combined Authority. It will help employers take on new workers through apprenticeships and the government's Kickstart scheme. And it will attempt to bring in new investment into the region, with new business and infrastructure projects creating new jobs. Unemployment has risen dramatically during the pandemic, and the end of furlough will leave many more without work. Figures for the 3 months to October showed 161,000 people unemployed in our region, a rate of 5.5% and a jump of 20% on the spring when coronavirus first arrived. That figure continues to rise, and Councillor Brookfield said the reason for the task force is to create jobs and find the right training for people. Jobs will be made an absolute priority for the whole of the West Midlands. We know how difficult the problem is. If we can reduce those percentages over the next 6 to 12 months, the task force will have done its job. 12 months ago, West Midlands unemployment was one of the lowest in the country. We were starting to go in the right direction, but now this has come along. In the last 9 months, unemployment has doubled, a number we have not seen for perhaps a good couple of decades. The Kickstart scheme aims to get young adults on benefits into work and boost apprenticeships. Despite rising unemployment, council leaders said there is much development to look forward to in 2021.
Three more local news bulletins coming up, but now it's time for our weekly update from Beacon.
Hi everyone, it's Helen here, wishing you all a very happy new year from everyone at the Beacon Centre. After such a challenging 2020, we'd like to say a huge thank you to everyone connected with our charity. That's a thank you to our staff and volunteers who have gone above and beyond to support people during a time of crisis. Thank you to you, our members, whose courage and resilience has amazed us. And a big thank you to everyone who supported us, with kindness and generosity that has kept us going. For many of our listeners, the Christmas season may have been a little different this year due to the coronavirus restrictions. But we hope whether it was a time of celebration or just a period of reflection that you were able to enjoy it. This week, we're going to crack on with some positive news. Firstly, we'd like to say a heartfelt thank you to our friends at Thomas Dudley who have made an incredible £5,000 donation to the Beacon Centre. It will help us buy some vital new equipment so our members can learn Braille and also allow us to expand our Fab Lab where we make and sell personalised products to support our work. We know many of you have expressed an interest in improving your Braille skills and hope the equipment will make a real difference in helping you to learn. What an amazing boost for our charity heading into the new year. This week we'd also like to thank everyone at the Wolverhampton One City Fund who earlier this year donated more than £2,000 to help us expand our Talking News service during the pandemic. With some of the funding, we were able to buy Amazon Echo Dots, which we've loaned out to people living in Wolverhampton to stay connected to the world and, of course, make it even easier to listen to our Talking News. If you are interested in becoming part of a loan scheme, just drop us an email on bctn@beaconvision.org or ring 01902 880111. Despite being able to start the new year with some brighter news, unfortunately, it's clear that COVID-19 is still having a significant impact on you, our members. As usual, if you feel you need additional support, please call us on 01902 880111 to see if we can help. The latest changes to restrictions, which have seen most of the Midlands moved into Tier 4, mean that sadly, we've had to close our shops again. We're devastated, not only for the impact on our amazing shop teams who are facing this uncertainty again, but that we'll also be losing income we so desperately need from our shops, which usually help raise around £9,500 for us every week. We'd like to say thank you to our dedicated shop staff and volunteers, and to all of you for your continued generosity. And as grateful as we are for the items you donate to our shops, please could you keep hold of them for now until we're able to accept them again. We're also looking at ways we can offer a click and collect service and how we might be able to accept some donations while our shops are closed. We'll keep you updated on that in the coming weeks. We hope to be able to reopen as soon as we can, but in the meantime, we need your help more than ever. You can donate £3 and send us a much needed virtual cuddle at the same time by texting HUG to 70085. Texts cost £3 plus one standard rate message. That's it for this week. Goodbye.
Thanks, Helen. Coming up next, we have more local news with Christine, Ed, Angela. But first up, it's Ian.
Wolves Molineux Stadium should be converted into a mass vaccination centre to allow as many elderly and vulnerable people as possible to get a COVID vaccine, a city MP believes. Jane Stevenson said the home of Wolverhampton Wanderers would be the ideal location to allow many people to easily access the Oxford AstraZeneca following its approval. The MP for Wolverhampton North East also wants Wolverhampton Council to include community and leisure centres as part of the rollout. Some football stadiums are already being used in this way, including Barnet's in North London and Bristol City's Ashton Gate ground. The rollout of COVID vaccines is expected to be ramped up in the next few weeks, with the aim of vaccinating as many people as possible in the battle to return to normality. Ms. Stevenson said, "With the positive news of the Oxford vaccine approved for use, the emphasis in our fight against coronavirus must now shift to vaccinating our elderly and vulnerable residents as quickly as possible so that we can ease the restrictions on our lives. So I'm calling on the local authority and the local NHS to use the Molineux Football Stadium as a mass vaccination centre for our city. Wolves fans have sadly not been able to go and watch the team play matches, but the club can still play a vital role at this crucial stage. Everyone knows where the Molineux is, and it has ample parking facilities which make it ideal for the purpose. I know other football stadiums across the country are being prepared as vaccination centres. I'm also urging Wolverhampton Council to make available its vast array of buildings, such as community centres which have been closed since the pandemic began in March. We must now vaccinate the priority groups as quickly as possible so that we can ease pressure on the NHS and reclaim the liberties and freedoms which have been taken away as a result of the pandemic."
Plans to invest millions of pounds into services across Dudley, including significant support for older people, are being put to the public. Dudley Council has put forward a range of investment services from April next year as part of its annual budget setting, which would see council tax rise by 4.99%. It includes investments in the care system and nursing, as well as maintaining investments in the voluntary sector. There's also money to meet the growth in demand for care for people with complex dementia and learning disabilities and rising costs of care. There are also plans to invest in the council's antisocial behaviour team, as well as creating more community support officers to pound the streets of the borough. Leisure is also in line for a boost, with proposals for a refurbishment programme at Hales Owen and Stourbridge's Crystal Leisure Centres next year, to add to the new Dudley Leisure Centre, which is already taking shape. To help fund the extra money, Dudley Council is planning to raise the basic rate of council tax by 1.99%, along with a 3% rise, which will go specifically to vital services for the elderly. It makes a total of 4.99% increase. But borough residents will continue to pay some of the lowest rates in the country, a rise of just over £1 a week for the average property. The annual budget consultation has now been launched to give people the opportunity to comment on the proposals before a final decision is taken in spring next year.
A councillor is set to appear in court after allegedly committing fraud to claim £10,000 from a COVID-19 grant scheme. Wolverhampton councillor Harman Banger will appear at Wolverhampton Magistrates Court over two offences between March the 11th and June the 5th. The case was first heard by the Black Country Magistrates Court on December 22nd, where it was adjourned until January the 11th next year. Banger of Bilston Road is accused of committing fraud by dishonestly making a false representation, a court listing said. It is alleged the 39-year-old, who faces two charges, did so to obtain a £10,000 grant under the government's COVID-19 small business scheme. The court document alleges that between the 11th of March 2020 and the 5th of June 2020 at Wolverhampton in the County of West Midlands, committed fraud in that you dishonestly made a false representation, namely obtaining £10,000 grant under the UK government COVID-19 small business scheme, intending to cause loss to Wolverhampton Council or to expose that person to a risk of loss for yourself, contrary to Sections 1 and 2 of the Fraud Act 2006. Labour councillor Banger, who represents East Park on the City Council, stood down from his role as the City's Economy Cabinet member after the allegations emerged in June this year. He was arrested by West Midlands Police in June and was released pending a full probe. He has also been administratively suspended from the Labour Group in the city pending the outcome of an internal party investigation. Nina Kumari, 37, and also of Bilston Road, has also been charged with the two offences.
More than 300 people with a history of rough sleeping have been helped off the streets and into their own accommodation thanks to the West Midlands Housing First pilot. The programme is overseen by the West Midlands Combined Authority WMCA Homelessness Task Force. It is headed up by Birmingham City Council alongside local authorities in Dudley, Sandwell, Walsall, Wolverhampton, Coventry and Solihull, in partnership with housing providers and homelessness charities across the region. Housing First is a government-funded initiative of £9.6 million over 3 years, which aims to help people with a long history of rough sleeping by providing a home and the wraparound support individuals need to rebuild their lives and stay in their accommodation. In the West Midlands, individuals are also given a small budget to make their new homes their own, thanks to pilot funding and money donated through the Change into Action scheme. Latest figures show that thanks to the scheme, 326 individuals have been supported into a place they can call home. Andy Street, Mayor of the West Midlands, said, "This is an important milestone for Housing First and proof that the scheme is having an impact. There is no doubt that this achievement has contributed to us reducing the number of rough sleepers across the region. Providing homes and support for people experiencing rough sleeping is a key priority, and I look forward to seeing more people benefiting from Housing First across the region." Jean Templeton, chair of the WMCA's Homelessness Task Force, added, "This milestone is a wonderful achievement. Housing First provides a necessary and important step to getting vulnerable people off the streets and into long-term accommodation with the right support."
Work steps up a gear on Aquatic Centre for Games. It will play a part in Black Country sporting history at the Commonwealth Games 2022, and work on the Sandwell Aquatic Centre is forging ahead in the new year. The centre is set to be completed in spring 2022, ready to be used for swimming and diving in the Birmingham 2022 event. And it is hoped the facility off Londonderry Lane in Smethwick will put Sandwell on the map through the popular events. The building will then be officially open for use by the public in May 2023 and will create a lasting legacy of the Commonwealth Games, which will be staged between July the 27th and August the 7th, 2022. It is the only new venue being built for the event, and it will feature a 50-metre Olympic-sized swimming pool, as well as a 25-metre diving pool, community swimming pool and seats for up to 1,000 spectators. The building will be officially open for use by the public in May 2023. Sandwell Council's Deputy Leader Maria Crompton said the facility was proceeding on schedule and it would be a great asset for decades to come alongside the Midland Metropolitan Hospital in the borough. Members of Safer Neighbourhoods and Active Communities Scrutiny Board were told last month work on the Aquatic Centre had briefly stopped so safety measures could be put in place for workers. Chiefs said they had been working for a long time to improve swimming facilities across Sandwell, with new centres in Wensbury, Tipton and West Bromwich over the past 5 years, plus Portway Lifestyle Centre, Oldbury, which includes a hydrotherapy pool. The new centre in Smethwick will be run by Sandwell Leisure Trust.
We have two more news updates coming up, but now it's time to cross over to Mina.
Hello, and yes, it's time for the first flashback quiz of 2021. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers this week in History section. But for now, here are your questions. Question 1. What everyday item was patented in 1888? Question 2. Which famous organisation was formed in 1912? Question 3. What was the name of the first ocean passenger liner? Question 4. What is Sherlock Holmes' full name? Question 5. In what year were the Harlem Globetrotters formed? And question 6. Who made the number one hit titled "Do You Think I'm Sexy"? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show. But for now, good luck.
Thanks, Mina. I'll get my thinking cap on for those. Next up, we have more local news from Ian, Christine, and kicking us off, it's Angela.
West Midlands Police has made more than £150,000 available to community groups funded by cash and assets seized from criminals. The initiative, led by Forces Police and Crime Commissioner David Jameson, is available to community groups helping the vulnerable during the COVID pandemic. Any organisation in the West Midlands can apply. A total of £157,522 is available from the Community Initiatives Fund, financed by items seized through the Proceeds of Crime Act. Announcing the fund, the Deputy Police and Crime Commissioner, Wahid Salim, said, "This fund has been a highlight this year, which has helped so many people maintain some contact in what has been a difficult and lonely year in many cases. This fourth round of funding is now available, and I would encourage those group eligible to apply." Building and strengthening communities is a crucial way to reduce crime and antisocial behaviour, as well as to build cohesion. This fund is doing just that right across the West Midlands. We've provided funding for a large number of organisations undertaking all sorts of work, from sports activity to groups combating loneliness. Each year, Mr. Jameson invites community groups to apply for the funding. This year's round of funding was launched in May and has been temporarily renamed from Active Citizens Fund to the Community Initiatives Fund. Applications will be open between January the 4th and the 15th.
There was an air of sadness as shoppers called in a Wolverhampton supermarket for the final time. Loyal customers and people shopping there for the first time came to the Waitrose store on Penn Road in Wolverhampton as it officially closed its doors after 16 years. The store is one of four around the country to close, alongside smaller stores in Shrewsbury, Caldecott and Ipswich, due to the chain being unable to make the shops profitable. As the store prepared to close ahead of a refurbishment to reopen as a Tesco in May, staff inside worked to clear the shelves, with a limited number of items still on sale ahead of the 6pm closing on December 31st. Shoppers coming to the store spoke of sadness at the store closing, with many reflecting on years of shopping there due to good quality food and friendly service. Maria Meegan from Romburn was doing shopping for the charity Outreach for Wolverhampton, picking up bottles of orange juice and a range of sandwiches and other products. The 55-year-old said she had been coming to the store every week for many years and spoke about the atmosphere inside the store. She said, "It's really sad going into there today as it just feels empty, with so many shelves looking empty as people are packing away. I know it's going to become a Tesco, so at least the site will still be used, but I know a lot of older people who are upset as they are so used to coming here and doing their shopping as it's familiar to them. I hope the staff are able to find work soon, whether it's with Tesco or elsewhere, as they've been brilliant and I really feel for them."
A wildlife campaigner has pleaded with people to dispose of fuel safely after a lake became polluted with diesel. Brenda Myers is among the volunteers who have helped with the clean-up operation at Bumble Hole Nature Reserve in Netherton, where birds have died and been rescued. The spillage was first reported on Tuesday the 29th of December, with the substance believed to have leaked through a culvert at Bumble Hole Pool. Local residents have since been working hard to help the authorities look after the wildlife and clean up the surrounding area. The Environment Agency, which is leading the operation, is trying to establish the cause of the leak, but has not yet confirmed the source. Ms. Myers, who has been a volunteer at the Nature Reserve for the past 3 years, said, "Apparently it is an illegal dumping of the pollutant. It has gone down the drain, and because of the culvert, it has entered through into the Bumble Hole Pool. That is like a storm drain. It has been washed from the drain it was dumped, along with all the rainwater into the Bumble Hole Pool. Some irresponsible person has decided to dump their diesel down the drain rather than getting rid of it in a responsible manner and pay for it. My message would be, please don't do it because you don't know what the knock-on effects are."
Two West Midland paramedics have revealed what it has been like working on the front line during the pandemic and over the Christmas period. Charlotte Stubbs from Dudley said she had worked most Christmas days from the age of 17 and spoke about her shifts over the festive period. She said, "This year I worked across Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day and 27th of December. I've never minded working on Christmas Day as all the patients we meet are usually so jolly and everyone is in really high spirits." She said she would work a minimum of 12 hours on Christmas Day, with the start of the day being very quiet, then picking up after 3pm to become a more hectic evening. She also said that as her parents had worked as A&E nurses during the festive period, it didn't feel any different for her to work on the day, with family celebrations instead taking place on December the 23rd. If I could ask of anything from everyone, it's that you thank your NHS staff for their consistent commitment and care. Karina Graham from Hollymoor in Birmingham spoke about her worries around catching the virus and passing it on to her children and family, while also describing some of the changes to her role during the pandemic. Writing in Harper's Bazaar magazine, she said, "Just about everything has changed at work to some extent, as we wear PPE to every case we go to now. We wear masks in the cab as we go to incidents. Just adapting the way we work to make sure elderly patients who might be deaf can either hear us or understand what we are saying through a mask makes the job a little bit more difficult. Through all the difficulties COVID has brought the NHS, my colleagues, whatever their role, have stood side by side supporting each other and ultimately the health system itself. I'm proud of what we've achieved."
Members of the public and volunteers have been praised for helping to support a food bank. The Bishop of Dudley, Martin Gorick, visited the Black Country Food Bank to see the work being done by volunteers during the Christmas period. He spoke about the work the team were doing and praised them, as well as thanking the community for their selfless donations during a difficult time. He said, "It was amazing to go along to the food bank and see just how hard everyone has been working to ensure people in Dudley have enough to eat in these challenging times. The food bank team have really gone above and beyond over the last few months, and our wonderful community has stepped up to support them. I am proud to be a bishop in the Black Country, where people across the borough have responded to the call to love their neighbour. Started in June 2006, the Black Country Food Bank is a Christian-based charitable organisation set up to feed local people experiencing real hardship by meeting their most basic need for food. The food bank has seen a 20% rise in people using their service this year, but thanks to donations, it has been able to meet the increased demand. Jen Coleman, CEO of Black Country Food Bank, said she had never seen the organisation so busy in 10 years of working there. She said, "Throughout the past year, we have seen the enormous generosity of so many different groups, with everyone pulling together to ensure we have enough stock. We've seen churches collecting donations in car parks, street collections, and people donating financially, including children giving us their pocket money. I'd like to thank everyone for their incredible support. It has made a difference to all those who are going through difficult times and need our help."
Now we have a new segment called Beacon Voices. We get to hear from the staff and volunteers whose work helps keep the organisation going. First up, we have the CEO of Beacon, Lisa Cowley.
Hello everybody, this is Lisa Cowley, Beacon Vision's Chief Executive. I'm doing this recording for the Black Country Talking News to share a little bit about me and my role and how that fits into the bigger picture of our charity. So I joined Beacon in December 2018. I came from a charity background, having previously been Deputy Chief Exec at the Black Country Living Museum, but hadn't previously worked in sight loss nor health and social care. So it was a really exciting new challenge for me, and over the last 2 years I've learned a huge amount about the challenges that face health and social care, and specifically those impacted by sight loss. And I've learned that not just from my colleagues and our partners, but from all of you, our members and those who have lived experience with sight loss. And a huge thank you to all of you for being so welcoming and so supportive to me in my role. So the team have asked me to share a little bit about how my role fits into the bigger picture of our charity. So as the Chief Executive, I lead our organisation. So I'm responsible for making sure that what we're doing is in accordance with our charitable objectives, and we're doing as much as we possibly can to have a positive impact on those that have sight loss and those that love and care for them. And that's been a challenge during 2020, looking at how we respond to COVID-19 and how we adapt our services. And it's something that we continue to need to evolve and change how we work so that we can continue to support you. And I think the amazing work that the Talking News team have done in terms of getting it out on new systems, you can listen to it on Alexa now, looking at how we can work with other partners has been a great example of how the team have adapted. And ultimately, as chief exec, I'm there to support the team and to inspire them to innovate and grow and take new steps forward. As a charity, we're always looking at different ways that we can support people, and we want to make sure that wherever you are in your sight loss journey, we're a beacon of hope that you can turn to. And I'm so very, very proud of everything that the team have done, especially during these very difficult times, and so thankful for all of the people that have supported us. And I don't just mean those that have given us donations, but those that have shared our story, those that have introduced new people to us so that we can help to support them, and those that have given up their time to us as volunteers and to specifically provide recordings and information for Talking News. It's hugely appreciated by all of us, and I know it's hugely appreciated by all of you. Now, the team have also asked if we can share some advice and tips. Now, as I've said already, I'm not a sight loss expert, so my advice and tips are going to be, I suppose, slightly more generic. And I think, you know, we're moving into 2021 now, we're in this new year, which will hopefully be less challenging and kinder than 2020 was. But I think there will still be challenges that we face as a charity, as individuals and as society. And so my hints and tips are ones that have helped me keep going through those dark days. And I think it is finding those things that make you smile. Now, the things that make you smile will vary. For me, it's quite often chocolate or biscuits, much to the team's frustration, as I generally raid their stores. It's also getting out into the countryside and doing some exercise, whether that's a walk or a run or riding my horse. And for some of you, you might think that that is something you can't do with sight loss, but it absolutely isn't. You know, we want to be here. If you want to get out riding a horse, we're going to help you do that. If you want to get out and go running, you know, I've done guide running with some of our members, and it's a brilliant experience, and we want to help you do that. And that's something that can still be done in a safe way. If you want to get out walking in those spaces, we're going to help you do that. And we're also going to raise awareness that it might be more difficult for you to do that in a socially distanced way, and raise awareness with the wider public about how they can support you. So my closing remark would be, whatever you're facing, however dark the day seems, those dark clouds will pass, and a smile can make us feel so much better.
Thanks, Lisa. Now we have a final local news section, starting with Ian.
The Green Duck Brewing Company has got quacking with canning beer to help revive sales during the coronavirus crisis. The independent brewery based in Rufford Road, Stourbridge, has been forced to shut its bar because of virus restrictions, but teamed up with Coventry's Twisted Barrel Brewery and Tap House to raise £25,000. The two breweries are now sharing the machine, and they also plan to rent it out to other local brewers too. Green Duck director Alex Hill said 10,000 cans of its beers had already been produced and were selling via its website and local off-licences. A new 6% beer called Maple Mild is proving the bestseller, along with another edition, Forged, a 4.5% strength best bitter. Forged is based on a recipe of my late grandfather, Bill Dingley, who was an avid home brewer in the 1970s, said Mr. Hill. He said overall sales this year had been massively down, but the growing interest in canned craft beer was helping.
A Pizza Hut restaurant has closed in the Black Country, bringing uncertainty to staff members. The American-owned company said the closure of its Bentley Bridge store in Wolverhampton was beyond its control. Work is taking place to redeploy employees to other restaurants in order to minimise the impact to our workforce, a Pizza Hut spokesman said. The company confirmed the restaurant, based at Unit 5 in the Leisure Park, would not be reopening in 2021. A spokesman said, "Unfortunately, the Wolverhampton Bentley Bridge Pizza Hut restaurant closure has been beyond our control, and we are doing everything we can to redeploy our team members to other Pizza Hut restaurants in order to minimise the impact to our workforce. We understand this is a difficult time for everyone involved and are supporting our team members as much as we possibly can.
An ecologist and broadcaster has spoken in support of controversial proposals for the future of Cannock Chase. One show presenter, Mike Dilger, has released a video supporting the £7.8 million master plan to close car parks, introduce parking charges and manage Cannock Chase over the coming years. Officials say the move is designed to protect wildlife and habitats across the chase, but critics say charges will put people off from visiting the beauty spot. Group Save Cannock Chase was formed in June by residents who noticed Chase Road had been closed off during lockdown and has since been protesting against Cannock Chase's Special Area of Conservation Partnerships plans. Now, Mike Dilger, who grew up close to Cannock Chase, talks of his early experiences of the range of wildlife to be found in the ecologically sensitive parts of the Area of Outstanding National Beauty. He says, "I am a Staffordian born and bred. As a child, I spent thousands of hours at Cannock Chase. It's the first place I saw a nightjar, an adder, a common lizard, and the habitat there, the heathland especially, is internationally important. It's the best site for wildlife within the county of Staffordshire." He speaks of his dismay to hear that diversity is decreasing, habitats fragmenting and species are disappearing from Cannock Chase, and goes on to urge the people of Staffordshire to get behind the proposals. He added, "Therefore, I plead with you, I implore you, please support these proposals. It's not about stopping you going wherever you want on Cannock Chase. It's about restricting primarily car access to the most vulnerable, the most sensitive areas that have been most important wildlife. Because if we don't act, it will simply disappear. The proposals are currently being considered by Staffordshire County Council."
A new space for creatives is opening in Wolverhampton in the new year. The Quarter Contemporary Arts Space in Chapel Ash will be a hub for local artists in the Black Country to showcase their work. It is located next to Asylum Art Gallery and Studios. Hannah Taylor, 29, owner, said, "It will be a commercial gallery and have extra space for contemporary art and artists' studios. The two floors above are currently filled with artists. Members will also be able to have access to the space, computers, internet, facilities and a space to sell and showcase work. As well as the commercial space, we will also have an event space as we have a stage and we are also hoping to run workshops in the future. The gallery in School Street will run through a monthly fee membership scheme with members of the collective having their say over activities that are on offer at the gallery. It is hoped that it will be able to open in mid-January, restrictions permitting." Hannah added, "We want to open in time for British Art Show 9, which is the largest touring art show in the country. There are no other places in Wolverhampton for local visual artists to showcase their work commercially. The Quarter will act as a hub for local artists. We are hoping we will have an opening date in mid-January when an update is made to the coronavirus restrictions. Even while we are closed, we can showcase pieces in our window as it is front-facing. For more information about the Quarter or becoming a member, contact the gallery directly."
A mother and daughter duo have been entertaining their street throughout the year to keep spirits up. Helen James, 48, and her daughter Keisha Thrower, 20, have hosted a number of special doorstep concerts outside of their home on Shaftesbury Road in Wensbury. Helen, who has recently gone back to study popular music at the University of Wolverhampton, used to tour the country singing. Due to COVID-19, she has not been able to get out on the road this year, but that has not stopped her putting her musical talents to use. On Christmas Eve, Helen and Keisha both performed a Christmas concert for their neighbours before the 6 p.m. bell ringing. Helen said, "We've been doing it all year through lockdown. We did a big VE Day performance as well as discos and songs for the NHS. As it was Christmas, we wanted to do something to cheer people up, so we put the speakers out and sang Christmas songs and carols. Keisha and I were out singing for around 1 hour and everyone absolutely loved it and said it felt a lot more like Christmas." Helen's husband Spencer Thrower has been helping with the sound during the performances.
We now head over to Flashback Roger, who, as always, is the man in the know.
Flashback. It's Roger here, and I'd like to wish you all a very happy new year with our first quiz for 2021. So here goes with this first of the year's flashback sections, where, as ever, we'll take a look back at some events from the week of the 3rd to the 9th of January from years gone by, and where you'll find the answers to the quiz questions that were set earlier. Well, on January the 3rd, 1888, Marvin Chester Stone of Washington, D.C., patents his invention of the paper drinking straw. Stone created his straw as a substitute for natural drinking straws, which were typically made from ryegrass. However, ryegrass straws quickly deteriorated in liquid and added to a grassy flavour to the drink. His invention consisted of a straw formed by winding a paper strip into a tubular form and securing the final or outer edge by an adhesive material, the whole being coated with paraffin wax or other waterproof material. And I personally have to say thanks, Marvin, otherwise how on earth could we slurp the last drops from the glass without a straw? January the 4th in 1912, the Boy Scouts Association is incorporated throughout the British Empire by a royal charter for the purpose of instructing boys of all classes in the principles of discipline, loyalty and good citizenship. The Boy Scouts Association had formed in 1910 to provide a national body in the United Kingdom to organise and support the growing number of scout patrols and troops which had begun to form spontaneously following the 1908 publications of the book titled Scouting for Boys by Robert Peyton Powell and the Scout magazine, of course. He and his wife later also formed the Girl Guide movement. January the 5th, 1818, the first ever ocean passenger liner set sail, the James Monroe, she was called. It set sail on its maiden voyage from New York to England. It arrived on February the 2nd. It was part of the famous Black Ball Line that established transatlantic voyages on a fixed schedule. Until then, ships arrived when winds and weather permitted, departed upon being loaded, and would add or remove stops along the way depending on their cargo. January the 6th in 1854 allegedly is the birthday of fictional detective Sherlock Holmes, whose full name, incidentally, is William Sherlock Scott Holmes, and I bet you never knew that, or didn't. The date is accepted to be that of his birthday, and as you'd expect, it was deduced from his stories. In the story, His Last Bow, in 1917, Holmes' age is given as 60 years old in 1914, although no actual date is cited. On January the 7th, 1927, the famed basketball team, the Harlem Globetrotters, played their first road game. Although the original players were from Chicago, their promoter Abe Saperstein chose the name New York Harlem Globetrotters, as Harlem was considered the centre of African-American culture at the time. Ironically, I did not play in Harlem until 1968, more than 40 years later. On January the 10th in 1945, British Rock and Roll Hall of Fame singer-songwriter Rod Stewart was born. Our ever-popular singer and performer has sold over 120 million records. His album, Every Picture Tells a Story, was from 1971 and was the first album to be simultaneously number one in Britain and the US. Maggie May was released in 1971 and Do You Think I'm Sexy was number one in 1978. So there you go, folks, the first of the year. And I hope that you're feeling suitably refreshed and ready for the quiz. But for now, I'll say good luck for it and ta-ra for now. Ta-ra!
That's Boston, Roger. Cheers for that. Now we have the weather with Mina.
The weather for this week ahead starts off dry and gets wetter as the week progresses, with cold temperatures hovering typically around 6 degrees. Light winds will be constant for most of the week, with sun not having too much of an appearance at all. As a result, we expect low UV levels all week. The sunrise and sunset times are 8:15 a.m. for the sunrise and 4:19 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday, 8th of January, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 3 degrees. On Saturday, 9th of January, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 4 degrees.
On Sunday 10th of January through to Tuesday 12th of January, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 7 degrees. On Wednesday 13th of January, we have light rain and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 6 degrees. And finally, on Thursday 14th of January, we have light rain showers and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 7 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. Enjoy the weather.
With news from our teams in the Premier League, up next is Ian with the latest from Wolves and West Brom.
Boss Nuno Espirito Santo says Wolves are ready to make decisions in the January transfer window. The Portuguese has made no secret of his desire to sign a new striker while Raul Jimenez recovers from surgery for a fractured skull. And when asked about potential reinforcements, Nuno said, "Of course, we have to sit down, plan. I think that it's a good chance to rebalance our squad. We will see, but we are ready to make decisions." Wolves have already been linked with several strikers, but for now, teenager Fabio Silva is the only fit centre-forward. Nuno has often shown faith in young players and said, "I already trusted them before the game. You trust them because you know they work hard. We know they are young and there will be mistakes, but it's up to us to correct the mistakes and make them become better. It's simple. We'll try to improve them. Football is made up of good moments and bad moments, and it's about how they react to it." Wolves threw away a two-goal lead to draw 3-3 away at Brighton. After recovering from an early Aaron Connolly strike, Wolves were seemingly in control. A Romain Saïss header, Dan Byrne own goal and Ruben Neves penalty handed the visitors a 3-1 lead at the break. But only 11 seconds into the second half, Brighton were handed away back into the game. João Moutinho foolishly tripped Neil Mope in the box and the striker stepped up to smash home a penalty. The Seagulls were in the ascendancy from there and peppered the Wolves' goal throughout the second half. After squandering several opportunities, Lewis Dunk rose highest from a corner to head in Brighton's third. The half was fizzling out until substitute Owen Otosowi blazed over a free header with the last touch of the game. In the end, the teams shared the points. Wolves find themselves in 13th place on 22 points and next face an FA Cup third round tie against Crystal Palace at home on Friday. Sam Allardyce says signing players who will immediately improve Albion's team will be key if they are to stay in the Premier League. "The window has only just opened and we will do what we can to find players in this pandemic," the boss said. "I think it will be the hardest window I've ever worked in. But if players are available, and this is said with no disrespect to my players at all because they are all trying as hard as they can, but I do have to try and find better to lift the squad and lift their confidence. That is what happened at every other club I have been at in the January window, and that has always been well greeted by the squad we already had. And we have always got better results and moved up the table. Any players we bring in have to be better than what we have and capable of going into the team immediately." Albion's miserable form in the Premier League continued after they were thrashed 4-0 at home by Arsenal. The Baggies ended 2020 by slumping to a 5-0 defeat at Leeds at the Hawthorns. And that misery continued into 2021 with Arsenal also securing a convincing victory in the West Midlands. A brace from Alexandre Lacazette as well as goals from Kieran Tierney and Bukayo Saka did the damage as Mikel Arteta's side cruised to a 4-0 win. The result means Albion have conceded 13 goals in their first four matches under new head coach Sam Allardyce, with 12 of those coming at home. It also means they have conceded a whopping 28 times this season, with the Baggies needing to drastically improve at both ends of the pitch if they are to have any chance of surviving in the Premier League. West Brom find themselves in 19th place with 8 points and next have an FA Cup fixture on Saturday away at League One Blackpool.
Thanks for that, Ian. We now join Ed, who this week is taking a look at how the Black Country Living Museum is taking the social media platform TikTok by storm.
How the Black Country Living Museum took TikTok by storm. The Black Country Living Museum has become a TikTok sensation during the coronavirus pandemic and is now listed among the top 100 UK accounts. The Tipton Road attraction had to close its doors to visitors twice during the national lockdowns, and when it has been open over the summer months, had to accept fewer visitors through the doors due to social distancing. Abby Bird, the museum's communications manager, was keen to find a virtual way to continue to share the Black Country story, especially to a younger generation who are connected online but are often underrepresented when it comes to physically visiting the museum. So the museum launched its own TikTok account in August and has since produced a wide range of engaging, educational and funny content designed to drive audience engagement. In just 4 months, the account has reached more than 10 million viewers and has grown from zero to more than 300,000 followers in that time, making it the most followed museum in the world on the TikTok app. Every video is now viewed by at least tens of thousands of people, with posts routinely reaching hundreds of thousands of viewers, and many getting into the millions. And in December, it reached new heights by being included on the official UK TikTok 100 list. Many of the museum's characters have taken on their own version of TikTok fame too, from the 1920s granddad giving his reassuring brand of Black Country life advice to the 1940s girl sharing the vital roles of women in Britain during the Second World War. The museum has also started playful trends, creating hashtag museum beef to engage other organisations to join in and take part in educational challenges. Museums both in the UK and further afield have continued to respond, including the Museum of London, Bemish and Old Salem Museums and Galleries in North Carolina. Miss Bird said, "We are now officially in the top 100 UK of TikTok accounts, and we are currently the most followed museum in the entire world on the platform. Worldwide pandemic or not, it would be impossible for that to not have a positive impact on us as a museum. Due to coronavirus restrictions, we are currently only able to welcome visitors physically to the site on limited days for our grounds only offer. Therefore, the kind of impact we are achieving with TikTok is a complementary way to make sure we are still building a long-term relationship with our audiences and through digital channels such as visits throughout the website, as well as social media reach and engagement, we will be able to foster that relationship, which puts us in a good position to drive physical visits for the future. Our success on TikTok enables us to build brand salience and stand out to potential new visitors, which is an enormous win. We are a museum and a charity, and as well as being financially independent, we are also here to tell the Black Country story and Britain's national story in a way that's accessible, meaningful and engaging." Natasha Eden, Chief Operating Officer at the Black Country Museum, added, "I'm absolutely thrilled with the museum's success on TikTok. It presents us with an incredible opportunity to meaningfully engage with a younger audience and showcase our wonderful museum and historic characters. As a museum and a charity, our fundamental goal is to tell the Black Country story in a way that is appealing and accessible. The pandemic has made this more apparent than ever. At a time when many of us are not physically able to visit museums, being able to occupy digital spaces in a way that captures people's attention and imagination is also important. This partnership will allow us to continue to do that in a new and creative way, and I can't wait to see what the future brings."
Cheers, Ed. At least now I know what TikTok actually is. Now we turn to our attentions to Mina, who has the answers from the flashback quiz. So Mina, are you ready?
I'm ready, as always. So, here are your answers for this week's quiz. Question 1. What everyday item was patented in 1888? And the answer? The paper drinking straw. Question 2. Which famous organisation was formed in 1912? It was, of course, the Boy Scout movement. Question 3. What was the name of the first ocean passenger liner? And the answer? The James Monroe. Question 4. What is Sherlock Holmes's full name? And the answer here is William Sherlock Scott Holmes. Question 5. In what year were the Harlem Globetrotters formed? And the answer, 1927. And finally, question 6. Who made the number one hit title, Do You Think I'm Sexy? And the answer here is, of course, Rod Stewart. How did you get on? Here's hoping you kicked off this year's quizzing successfully. Of course, there will be another quiz next week, but for now, to end this edition, we have for you Graham Fisher's Tales from the Barn.
Hello. I don't suppose for a moment that Stourbridge is the crime centre of the Southern Black Country. Indeed, my instincts would convince me precisely the opposite. But no doubt it has spawned its fair share of villains over the years, and equally, its fair share of fine detectives to track them down. So, to use the legal terminology, there would seem to be no prima facie justification in adding to the factual by accentuating the illusory. Yet Stourbridge can lay fair claim to its fair share of high-profile fictional crime solvers. Again, to use the jargon, res ipsa loquitur, or, if your school day's Latin is as rusty as mine, the facts speak for themselves. Just check your local library or trawl the internet for names. Thus, armed with a selection from which to choose, I'm looking here at just two of them. And I find that the myriad twists and turns of connections is, per se, there, I've done it again, worthy of a category all of its own. William Gillette, Basil Rathbone, Peter Cushing, Douglas Wilmer and Robert Downey Jr. are just a few of the names who have portrayed Sherlock Holmes on stage, screen and television over the past 100 years or so. But until the more recent interpretation of Benedict Cumberbatch, that gloriously, if somewhat eccentrically, brought the world's greatest consulting detective bang into the 21st century, it was the 1980s portrayal by the late Jeremy Brett that set something of a benchmark in capturing the very quintessence of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's creation. Or should I more accurately say nemesis? For that is what Holmes eventually became to Conan Doyle, a writer whose eloquent skills ranged from tales of ancient times to the adventures of the dashing Hussar officer Brigadier Gerard, yet who could not, by public demand, shake off the shackles imposed upon him by Holmes, even despite his apparent demise alongside Moriarty at the Reichenbach Falls. He just had to be resurrected. As I look out from the barn across the sylvan green fields nestling in the foot of the Black Mountains, and if one can't find inspiration here, then it really is time to give up, I am minded of an observation by Holmes, which I quote, "It is my belief, Watson, founded upon my experience, that the lowest and vilest alleys in London do not present a more dreadful record of sin than does the smiling and beautiful countryside." Purple stuff. I just happen to know that's from The Adventure of the Copper Beeches, and so I suppose that I must declare an interest here, insomuch that I've been a Sherlock Holmes devotee for most of my adult life and a member of the eponymous society for about the same length of time. But enthusiast as I am in what we call playing the game, I appreciate that for the benefit of those who do not quite share my enthusiasm to the same extent, it may be helpful to explain that, in the Jeremy Brett series at least, there was not one, but two Dr. Watsons. The Copper Beeches and others in the early series featured a youthful David Burke. But in the later series, when time had inevitably marched on, and it was necessary for a more mature-looking Watson to be seen at Holmes's side, he was played by Edward Hardwicke, who was recommended by Burke specifically for the role, and he's the man at the nub of our story. Edward Cedric Hardwicke, 7th of August 1932 to 16th of May 2011, was born in London. But if the family name is already beginning to ring mental bells, his father was Sir Cedric Webster Hardwicke, an English stage and film actor whose career spanned over 50 years. Ah! Now those mental bells are really clanging. Hardwicke Way, Stourbridge, the Cedric Hardwicke Memorial at Lye Cross. Yes, Cedric Webster Hardwicke is one of our most famous sons. He is, as they say in these parts, one of we. And I would suggest that his own son, fueled by Black Country genes, didn't fare so bad either. To add to the mix, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle himself actually lived for several years just a few miles up the road in Aston Road North, Birmingham. But now, in slightly differing vein, and at some distance along the detective genre spectrum, let us divert our gaze several thousand miles to the west, specifically America, where for many years the whimsical Murder, She Wrote was a hugely popular detective series featuring a somewhat unconventional, if not highly intelligent, female writer-turned-sleuth named Jessica Fletcher, as portrayed by one Angela Lansbury. The series has, of course, long migrated to British screens. Indeed, my own mother's a big fan, and I watch them myself occasionally. But if you're not into it, then think of a 20th century Miss Marple, with New England accents and fancy automobiles. All save Miss Lansbury, who has an increasingly rare, distinguished English accent that denotes upper class, but with the crusts cut off. Lansbury was nominated for a total of 10 Golden Globes and 12 Emmy Awards for her work on Murder, She Wrote. She holds the record for the most Golden Globe nominations and wins for Best Actress in a Television Drama Series and the most Emmy nominations for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama Series, with those nominations collectively actually netting her 4 Golden Globe Awards. And there were further awards as well. It really was popular, but no doubt you already get my drift. And all centred around one Ms. Lansbury. But from whence did that crisp English accent originate? Well, to answer that, we migrate but a short distance from the birthplace of Cedric Hardwicke to Cradley Heath, where names such as Lansbury Road and Lansbury Green give clues in our mystery. George Lansbury, 22nd of February 1859 to 7th of May 1940, was a British politician and social reformer who actually led the Labour Party for a while from 1932 to 1935. Apart from a brief period of ministerial office during the Labour government of 29 to 31, he spent his political life campaigning against established authority and vested interests, his main causes being the promotion of social justice, women's rights and world disarmament. He spent his final years travelling through the United States and Europe in the course of peace and disarmament. George had a son, Edgar, who in turn fathered Angela. The family evidently had connections in the Black Country. And just how do I know that? Well, a late friend of mine, a funeral director and a Cradley Heath mon born and bred to his bootstraps, oft used to reminisce wistfully about the times he chastised the playful baby Angela or changed a nappy, although I doubt Mlle would be too happy to see that on her otherwise distinguished CV. So there you have it, the world's greatest fictional detective, a hugely popular television series across the other side of the world, famous thespians and memorable characters, all linked by the commonality of theme that is our local area. And, to top it all, a colleague of mine working on this very broadcast, herself a keen historian and genealogist, is investigating possible links with her forebears, who may have shared a surgery with Conan Doyle, himself, of course, a trained doctor. Now, it might be an amusing exercise, might it not, to collate all of these facts, take them to a local bookmaker, and get the odds of them all coming together in this intriguing manner, and all on our patch. It is quite amazing what can be discovered simply by scratching a little beneath the surface. And you don't have to be a detective, fictional or otherwise, to do it. Enjoy your Black Country, and do join me again soon for more Tales from the Barn.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org. or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!